The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I mean, I think about her all the time. I mean, was she being prepared to where she would go on to another life? Sometimes I still get emotional about this.
Often used the term young woman to describe Carla Jan Walker, and it's fitting. She was strong, thriving, precocious, and motivated. It would be careless and misrepresentative, however, to let that description define the point of life at which she was when her life was maliciously taken. Carla had turned 17 years old less than a month before her February 1974 death. She was a teenager, an adolescent, a child, as our society defines the term by law. Carla was a beloved daughter and sister, a treasured friend, and an adored girlfriend. Over the course of this podcast, of Carla's story, many loved ones have recounted the impact that Carla had on their lives and the devastating heartache that her murder wreaked, particularly considering that the madman, the monster, who perpetrated the vicious and reprehensible act has never faced justice, at least for this crime. So, who was responsible? We've covered several suspects. But can any be excluded from suspicion or speculation? Since most violent crimes against women are perpetrated by a male close to them, Rodney McCoy was considered a person of interest immediately as per standard procedure, but was quickly ruled out. DNA science started becoming a standard in law enforcement investigations years after Carla's death. And in the mid-1990s, Rodney was asked for a sample. He complied, of course, and was once again cleared. In May of 2003, then-Fort Worth Police Sergeant J.D. Thornton announced to the Fort Worth media, quote, "We did some more DNA testing that came up negative on some of the existing names we had as possible suspects. We received the results of those, and they said they were negative as far as any matches." End quote. Though Detective John Terrell collected an impressive amount of circumstantial evidence against William Ted Wilhoit, much of which is, upon immediate examination, incredibly damning, there remain issues that the officer often glossed over or simply didn't seem to consider. First, Wilhoit's sexual assault M.O. has never consisted of abduction, and the attacks have always taken place in the victim's homes, never an automobile. Burglary always appeared to be as much of a motive of the crimes that he perpetrated, and nothing of value was taken from Carla or Rodney. Though Wilhoit did shoot one of his victims, it is likely that he did so as a result of panic. All indications lead us to believe that Carla's abductor remained calm and in control. Wilhoit has never used drugs to sedate his victims. He was below the average height for a Caucasian American male, standing only 5'7" tall, 3 inches less than the attacker was said to be. He didn't wear Western-style clothing, including a cowboy hat, as Carla's attacker was said to have worn. The bowling alley that Carla was abducted from was about 7.5 miles from Wilhoit's residence at the time, and there was a bowling alley about a block away from his home in 1974. Former Chief Deputy Jim Minter told us that William Ted Wilhoit was heavily scrutinized and, quote, "there was just nothing there," end quote. We recently began corresponding with a source who became involved with the Walker family, and thus Carla's case, in the early 2000s, who confirmed many of our doubts as to Wilhoit's involvement in Carla's abduction and murder.
I don't remember if Jim called me or if he got in contact with me through Cheryl's website, but prior, I had talked to Mrs. Walker not too long after I got out of law school because they had told her that they weren't going to let Cheryl come look at the files, but they would let the family come look at the files with a lawyer. And I told her I'd be glad to help her, you know, just let me know. And I didn't hear back from her for a while, and I checked with her again, and she wasn't interested in doing anything right at that time. So I know she had my number, but I don't remember exactly if Jim called me or if Cheryl gave him my number through the website or whatever. But anyway, Jim and I ended up, we all went to a meeting at Cheryl's house. And Cheryl had a bunch of paperwork, including the copy of the autopsy report I told you about that he showed us, that Tora saw the deal about the morphine. We started trying to contact a bunch of different people. There was a lady Cheryl had talked to who Cheryl said could place Wilhoit at the bowling alley that night. Cheryl said that this lady in the bowling alley, quote, thought that whoever this person was that she saw at the bowling alley was stalking her. And then when Carla came in, he took his attention off of her and started kind of stalking Carla. And I know one of the complaints the police had about Cheryl was the way he showed people pictures and stuff. And you know how much Nealon and Wilhoit's pictures back then look alike. He kind of got, you know, he was like, you know, he kind of got banned from the police department. And nobody's supposed to talk to him. Danny LaRue, a former Fort Worth police officer that is now a PI, had worked on the Janelle case and might know something about Carla's case, and that Danny LaRue was the best the Fort Worth PD ever had. He said he didn't work directly on Carla's case, but only indirectly in connection with Janelle's case. He said his money on Carla's case would still be on Tommy Ray Nealon, as the MO fit him more than Wilhoit, and Nealon was, quote, cowboy, and Wilhoit was, quote, more preppy. I told Cheryl what LaRue had told me. Cheryl said George Hudson was also convinced Nealon was guilty of Carla's murder. This is something else that LaRue said. The difference between Wilhoit and Nealon was that, to use polite language, Wilhoit was a wuss, and he didn't think he would have ever attacked two people. He also said Wilhoit was a stalker who waited until he had the situation he wanted, and Carla's seemed to be more of a crime of opportunity. And I think it was towards the end of October 2004 that Jim and I met with Detective Waters. So it was March of 2005 that we got her the information of exactly where Nealon was in the El Reno Federal Prison in Oklahoma. And that's the time that Jim also sent them the letter about requesting the Rangers cold case unit be called in. So in 2005, we gave her the information about Nealon. She did know, she had checked into it and found out there was a warrant on him for parole violation. And so she had the officer that had the warrant check and make sure that the one I found was the right person, and it was. And she was going to try to make a trip up there and talk to him. So that's kind of the last I heard for a while. What she sent back to me was, as far as Tommy Nealon goes, there's nothing so far. He refused to see me, and federal prisons adhere to the prisoner's wishes. The only good thing is when federal prison gets through with him, he has to be shipped back to Texas. So after that email with her, I looked Neelan up on the federal prison locator, and he was out of federal prison. So then I looked him up on the Texas prison locator, and that's where I found him, at the Stiles unit. So that's October 2009. I sent that to her, and she said, I did not know he was back in Texas. I can plan a trip to talk to him now. He still doesn't have to talk to me, but he won't just have to tell me to the face. And then she, and another email right around in October, she said, I will have our tech in the crime lab check to see if Neelan's DNA is in CODIS. I guess I had talked to her on the phone. We were talking about whether he would have had to get it when he came back to Texas. And she said, sometimes under these situations, it falls through the cracks. And then another email in October, she didn't really say anything else about the DNA or whether they had had any additional evidence that might link him to Carlos. Around September of 2004, this is before Detective Waters got on it, Sergeant Thornton was the cold case detective for Carlos' case, and he had publicly stated that Will Hoyt was no longer a suspect. I don't remember the exact words, but I feel pretty sure that Waters assured me and Jim that Will Hoyt was not the one, which made me think the DNA testing had been done on him. There's definitely the opportunity that they could have done Will Hoyt, plus he was in the prison, and as a sex offender at that point, they probably, you know, could have made him give it, or they had it from some other crime that he did. If Neelan's DNA has never been ruled out, then he would still be on the top of my list.
Tommy Ray Neelan, who'd been arrested for an attempted kidnapping in which he absurdly bungled, had previously committed savage and heinous crimes. Some details of Neelan's life are potentially viable for a circumstantial argument as to his involvement in Carla's homicide. He bowled weekly, though at a bowling alley in Hearst. He had a disdain, or what he led on to be disdain, for women showing skin, so to speak. A detail that has confounded us is that Neelan insisted that he raped his teenaged female victim, Mary Jane Handy, though the highly respected Tarrant County Chief Medical Examiner, Felix Gwotes, found absolutely no signs of the sexual assault of the teenager. He would, however, not recant this seemingly false admission. While his crimes, perhaps, match the M.O. of the perpetrator of Carla's homicide slightly more fittingly than Will Hoyt, there are inconsistencies. The police didn't find any evidence of Neelan owning a .22 Ruger pistol. His known guns included a .30-30 rifle, a Russian sniper rifle that he'd brought back from Vietnam, and a double-barreled .22 pocket pistol. Neelan isn't known to have worn a cowboy hat at any time. He stood noticeably short for a male at 5'6" tall and had what was described as a beer belly at the time of Carla's abduction and murder. Neelan's wife at the time of his 1974 arrest reports that he worked weekdays at the time. He was a carpet layer and was always home nights and weekends. She provided us with further details of the arrest and of Neelan in general.
Yeah, most of the time he was happy. You know, of course, as a married couple, we did have our disagreements, but, you know, he was happy and easy to get along with, tried to get along with everybody. He wasn't into drugs, but he did drink. Yeah, he was teaching the teenage Sunday school class, and they all liked him. Well, when they came to the house and arrested him, we were still in bed asleep, and they were fixing to bust in the front door when I hollered at them, and they were at the back door also, and I think they were at several windows to make sure he didn't crawl out of a window, and got both the boys up and brought them to me. They did let him put clothes on before they put handcuffs on him. They didn't come in for Carla. They came in for some girl that he had kidnapped a few days before and turned loose, and she gave him a good description. He had already been in their custody for a couple of days, I think, And he called me at 2:30 in the morning and told me that they wanted me to come in the next day. And I think he gave me a time and, you know, to be up there so I could talk to him. And since they had both of our vehicles, I had to get somebody to take me up there. They was asking me questions about Tommy. I think they were trying to pin part of it on me. I went ahead and allowed them to do a polygraph, and that's when they decided to lock me up, said I was lying, you know, and all kinds of things. And they put me in a cell. They let the preacher come in for a few minutes, and other than that, they would not let anybody see me, including a part-time Fort Worth police officer. That guy was a neighbor of ours, and he asked to see me, and they wouldn't let him. I spent the night by myself. I wouldn't eat anything while I was there. They did allow me to have my asthma medication. And then the next morning, one of the officers or detectives pulled me out. He was probably the tallest one, and he was heavy set, and, you know, thinking he could scare me because he knew I was crying when they put me in. I think they were trying to scare me into saying, you know, that he did it. I knew he did it, and I was with him or something like that. And I called the lawyer, and he said, meet me at the county courthouse. Not after that, they didn't ask me any more questions, and they released me. Just believe thought the cops were lying. You know, he never raised a hand to me. And I know people that's heard the story, you know, one of their first questions is, well, did he hit you? No, he never hit me. And, you know, not to ever show any violence towards me and then go out and do something like that just didn't make sense to me. It still doesn't make sense to me. Working as a mechanic, he was always cutting himself and always had blood on his shirts. I never thought anything about it. So he just throw them in the floor in his closet and then gather them up and take them into work when they, you know, they had to be turned in to be cleaned. So I never paid much attention to him. Like I said, I never, you know, he was always cutting himself. I didn't even think about him hurting somebody and cutting himself. Well, he worked at night, so he was gone at nights all the time. There was a detective here a few years ago. I'm sorry, I don't remember her name, and I threw her card away, asking me questions about him and, of course, asking about Carla Walker and everything. And she said when she left me, she was going to go down and talk to him. Guess she couldn't come up with enough to get him convicted then. When Carla came up missing, I knew where he was. My sister was with us, and we were celebrating my brother-in-law's birthday. He had to go to work, so he missed the party. And we went and ate pizza, and we just kind of rode around, the three of us, till it was after midnight. And then, of course, then we had to go home to see about our kids. So,
since mandatory DNA collection laws for felons didn't go into effect until 2009 in the state of Texas, a sample from Tommy Ray Neeland wouldn't have been collected unless court-ordered. This certainly seems problematic regarding Carla's case, and if his DNA has not been collected and compared to her murderer, Neeland must remain a viable suspect. However, it seems just as likely that the perpetrator of the abduction and murder of Carla Walker is an individual who isn't necessarily known to the public at large, or even those familiar with the case. In 1974, the FBI estimated that a sexual assault occurred every 11 seconds. The same year, there were 67 murders and 136 rapes in the city of Fort Worth. Also in 1974, Texas Christian University sociology professor Francis King created the Tarrant County Task Force on Rape, which worked with and educated law enforcement on everything from rape cases and trials to providing rape crisis counseling and women's self-defense classes. Local law enforcement called rape the most underreported crime in 1974 due to fear and embarrassment, including the fear of reprisal from the rapist, public shame and accusations of provocation, and being a scorned, active participant. In 2016, rape remained the most underreported crime, with 91% of assaults unreported to police. We've become aware of many violent sexual assaults against women since beginning our research into Carla's case, some of which the perpetrators hold records for offenses in the 1970s, and some that were potentially offending during the time as well. If we look past Wilhoit and Neeland, two persons of interest who were investigated and scrutinized for many years without providing answers, if we look past the possibility of Carla's school peers being involved, as Rodney is adamant about, if we step out of the box that this investigation has been tucked neatly away in, perhaps pertinent information can come to light. To do this, though, we need to shift our focus and change the course of Carla's case, a course that was also created by speculation that never bore fruit. We need to start looking at other possibilities of who her abductor could have been. We believe, as does everyone close to this case, that it was someone who was very familiar with the area, someone who hung out at the local establishments, someone who had a history of violence or rape. Given the nature of this brutal act, it is highly doubtful that this was his first or last crime. It is possible that this attacker had a criminal history that includes rape, assault, drugs, kidnapping, or any combination of these. When Carla was taken, so many people were out searching, investigating, and asking questions. We need this again, particularly now while memories can still be sparked and examined. Carla Walker, the Walker family, Rodney, everyone who ever loved or was touched by the remarkable young woman, deserves justice. We talked with one individual who Carla affected immeasurably. She was Carla's closest friend at her untimely death. Besides the unavoidably eerie details of some seemingly foreboding circumstances that we came across, the police officer who showed Carla's tennis class the women's self-defense film 2 days prior to the abduction, and the police officer at the dance who told Rodney to be careful and take care of Carla just hours before, were a couple accounts that her dear friend shared with us.
On the weekends, Carla would, one night she would be with Rodney, her boyfriend, and one night she would choose to be with the girls or just me, and we would, you know, drive around and go to different places. And so it was a couple of weekends before she had gone, and I don't know if it was a Friday or Saturday night, which night I was with her, and we were driving around, and she knew that I had been baptized several months before. And so she asked me how I felt about being baptized. Did I think that she had to be baptized before she could go to heaven? And my interpretation at that time was that I told her, no, Carla, that's, you know, between you and your Savior and God. And if you've asked him to come into your life, then you will go to heaven. You know, being baptized at that time to me meant that she did that so that other people would know that she had asked God to come into her life. And so she said, oh, that makes me so happy because whenever I die, I want to go to heaven, you know, and I haven't been baptized yet. And of course, I didn't think anything about that because you think you're here forever, you know, and as young as we were and stuff. So, but I thought that was kind of interesting. I never forgot that conversation. I can remember exactly where we were when she was driving. And then Friday before this happened on, I guess you'd say late Saturday night or Sunday morning time-wise. But anyway, it was a Friday before, and it was a school day, and we had our first period class was PE, and we had it together. And she came in that day and said that she just kind of felt nervous inside. She had felt like something was about to happen. She thought maybe the reason she felt that way was because she had gone to her brother, who was married at that time, and her sister-in-law, they were having dinner or party or something there. And her sister-in-law, the sliding glass door was closed, and the sister-in-law didn't know, and so she was walking, and her hand went through the glass door or something, and it, she said it was just kind of hairy, you know, because she was bleeding and stuff like that. So she said, maybe that's why I feel kind of nervous. Well, then we went into class, into the gym, and we had a speaker that day, a police officer speaking on the subject of how girls and women can protect themselves. And Carla and I, it was a fairly small class. It was a tennis class. And so we just kind of sat there. I mean, we did listen to him, but we were kind of joking and laughing like, yeah, you know, really wasn't taking it very seriously, but we did listen. And so I thought that was kind of interesting too, that that had happened just right before the next day, this or evening, night, this had happened to her. And I can't remember how I knew this, if her dad had told me this or Carla had told me this, but we had had a friend that was killed in a car accident. It was a guy several months before, and we had gone to, a lot of us had gone to the funeral, and she'd gone to the funeral. And on the way home from the funeral, she told her dad exactly where she wanted to be buried, what kind of flowers she wanted. And so it was kind of like, I don't know, I mean, was she being prepared to where she, you know, would go on to another life? So anyway, that's always kind of stayed with me. And I know that she is in a better place as far as, you know, she, her faith was strong, in other words. We sure didn't miss her, and we wanted her here, but she's in a good place. Ooh, sometimes I still get emotional about this.
But most of what Carla's best friend had to offer us consisted of happy memories that were strikingly emotional accounts of the life that was lost. The recollections shared here provide great insight into Carla's personality and young life.
Being friends with her since third grade, and I mean, we were really close third grade to about sixth grade, seventh grade, and then about eighth or ninth grade kind of slipped away. Our friendship did for a little bit, but then it came back stronger than ever, you know, about the end of ninth grade, first part of tenth grade. And until she passed away, we were very, very close. And Carla was full of energy, pretty headstrong. In her own way, she was kind of private. I mean, she had lots of friends, but she wasn't open to everyone and telling them everything. She was, in some ways, kind of a, was better with one or two best friends at the time and confiding in them. But she still had lots of friends. Everyone, she was funny, loved to be around her. Her whole family was just fun. Family was real important to her. And, you know, she had lots of siblings, and I was just from a family of two, so it was always, I loved the stories and stuff. And she was definitely very close to her dad, especially. She could work him really well, and Mr. Walker would do anything for her and get whatever she wanted. She had some way of manipulating him to do whatever, but it was a healthy way. She wasn't sneaky or, you know, vindictive. She just knew what she wanted, and, you know, and that's how she did with everything. When she liked Rodney, she really liked Rodney, and that was going to be her boyfriend, and it happened. So she was fun. People loved her, but she wasn't open just with everybody about, you know, private stuff. She did like having one or two very close friends. I could trust her. You know, she was just a great friend. We did a lot of fun things for slumber parties, and I would have a slumber party about once a month, and we would have anywhere from 13 to 24, 25 girls for the night. And Carla always came to those, and she was always one that would stay up and, you know, put us through the night, and just really fun. And we would get out and go teeping and do some of those things. And one time we did get caught teeping and taking for sale signs out of a bunch of new homes and, you know, switching them around and that kind of stuff. So the police kind of had fun with us that night. It was the Denver police, and they took us in to the police station and then called my dad and told him that he would have to come get us, and a couple of the girls could come and get their purses with their driver's license in it, because not everyone had, you know, not everyone was 16 at that time. But Carla was always right in the middle of that, and fun, so much fun. I would spend the night at her house some, and there was another friend that she would spend the night at her slumber parties. But the funny thing about Carla was, other slumber parties that she would come to, she never would end up staying through the night. You know, she would call her dad. It didn't matter if it was 10 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, and he would come pick her up and take her home. She was kind of a homebody as far as that goes. She liked being in her own bed and being with her family. But if it was at my house or my other friend's house, she would spend the night through the whole night at our house. And that was just, there were some good times at the slumber parties. And I had told you earlier about, you know, our friendship had gone all the way back to third grade. She was kind of the teacher's pet. And that wasn't unusual, too. Teachers liked her just as well as the kids did. So in third grade, I remember our teacher. I remember out of the girls, Carla was, you know, kind of the teacher's pet in that class. But we had matching outfits with another friend of ours. And we would call each other and say, hey, let's wear our go-go boots and our blue jumpers tomorrow, you know, and we'd show up and we'd be matching, and we thought we were really cool, you know. So our friendship started really strong in third grade. And then because of our friendship, our parents also became good friends. And so whenever Carla was taken from us, my parents were pretty involved with kind of helping the walkers through that time and talking with different detectives and people that were working on the case. You know, I did take a family trip with them one time to Big Springs, and that was a fun weekend, you know, getting to meet her extended family. I mean, I knew her sister really well and her younger brother, but he was just that much younger than us that it was kind of, at that time, we felt, you know, a pain to us sometimes. But, and her sister's boyfriend at that time, real close to them. Her brothers were quite a bit older, so I knew them, but never real well, you know. Spent a lot of time with their family. Love them. Christmas was a big thing at their house. Oh my gosh. Mr. Walker, her dad, did all the shopping, and he started like in October, you know, shopping, and they would have gifts that covered the whole den all the way up to the ceiling, and it was just crazy. And then like Carla's boyfriend, Rodney, I mean, they took him in just as part of the family. They were real good about that, of making their boyfriends or their good friends just feel a real part of the family. And so, and we could call her dad if we were spending the night at my house, or if we were at her house, we could call her dad. And there was a restaurant, Kip, and they had real good hot fudge sundaes that Carla loved. And so we could call her dad, and he'd drive us by our boyfriend's houses at that time and honk the horn and then take us to Kip's to get a hot fudge sundae, you know. And that could be 10 o'clock at night, that could be 12 o'clock at night. He was always at her beck and call, and, you know, those were good memories with her, too. Whew. That was something else we used to do. And I guess we started it in junior high, and we kind of did it through high school. Every Christmas, we would go and see Santa Claus and sit on his lap and have our picture made. We do that every year. So that was something that we used to do together that was fun and good memory. And we got really, our friendship really, really close, I would say, the last 6 months before she was, you know, taken from us. We were really, really close, and I'm so thankful for the time that we spent together and the conversations we'd have on the phone, and, you know, talking about her planning to, she and Rodney wanted to go to the same college. They wanted to go to Tech, if I remember right. And he had given her a promise ring, and she really thought that was going to be the one. And he was as crazy about her as she was about, anyway, that's, I'm thankful for the time that we had together. It's too short, but I promise I have felt her presence through my whole life. You know, graduating, going to college, getting married, you know, having children. I have always felt her presence, and I really do mean that. I know that she has been a part of my life, even though she's not here on earth. You know, I mean, I tell people that I work with something. I mean, it's not like I go and tell everybody, you know, what happened in my life, but she comes up a lot in my life, you know, just certain things that will happen. And I'll say, oh, yes, one of my best friends, you know, was taken from me, you know, or not me, but taken from us. And I mean, I feel the pain still. It's just something that certain times when I talk about it, even with my own daughters or, you know, friends, sometimes when we talk about it, we still get upset about it. And certain times when I think about it, it's more painful. And I'm over the anger part of it. And I think, I don't know, you know, her Jimmy and Cindy may have still have, I don't feel as angry as I did for a long, long time, but the emotional part is still there. I want her to always be remembered, and I think about her all the time. When Carla passed away, her parents gave us all this last picture that they had for her. You know, that a photographer had taken. It was one, I know you have that, because it was one that was showed all the time, you know, when she was kidnapped. And they gave us all that in a frame. And I kept that in my room forever. Even after I went off to college, those pictures were up in my room. Always had her with me. Well, it's really funny how people that I've met over the years, they might have grown up in Fort Worth or around Fort Worth, and if they're around my age or older, didn't know them then. They didn't know Carla, didn't know them, but they all knew the story.
We have come to the end of a consecutive series of episodes on Carla Walker and her story. We are by no means finished with her case. Any and all new information collected or brought to our attention will render new episodes on the case, and we look forward to shedding additional light and coming closer to justice for Carla. If you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Detective Jeremy Roden at 817-392-4307. We won't be releasing an episode next Monday due to the holiday. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, we will begin looking into the cases that the press dubbed the February slayings. These cases, some believed, shared similarities to the Carla Walker case and occurred over a period of several years before and after. We'd like to thank Kathleen Barnett, Barbara, Connie Carnes, Rodney McCoy, and former Tarrant County Chief Deputy Jim Minter for their contributions to this episode. As always, thank you to the Walker family for their unwavering and continued support. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, Auto Radio, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the case and post pictures, so please join in. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Carla's story with a friend, or stop by our Patreon page and make a small donation. If you enjoy true crime, please check out thetruecrimefiles.com. The True Crime Files presents interesting and well-written cases. They will not disappoint. Thanks for listening, y'all.
for you, my darling. Please won't you walk right inside. There's room for no one but you, my darling. For you the door is open wide. Just follow the pathway that leads to love that's true. I'll light a candle, I'll keep it burning just for you. There's room in my heart for you, my darling. My darling, no one but you. Darling, please won't you walk right inside. There's room for no one but you, my darling. For you the door is open wide. Just follow the pathway that leads to love that's true. I'll light a candle, I'll keep it burning just for you. There's room in my heart for you, my darling. My darling, no one but